Back to the second conference session. I'm David Setters. I'm a senior associate at Contango Markets. This is an independent consultancy which works with exchanges, both large and small, and brokerage firms, IT vendors, etc. And we help people enter new markets, whether by geography or by asset class. We have a bias towards the commodity area, especially as my colleague, who's not here, Clive Furness, comes from a commodity background as a senior executive at Goldman Sachs, the London Commodity Exchange, as it was, and Life, as it was. We've worked extensively in and with emerging markets. Our topic this afternoon is, can the technological leadership of Asian exchanges be exported to emerging markets? Now, my teachers told me to look at the question when I do an exam, so I looked closely at this question, and I thought, and of course I have shared this with the panellists, that the question can, in fact, be divided into two parts. Firstly, there's an implied question, in that the question suggests that Asian exchanges do have technological leadership over European or American or technology for anywhere else, for that matter. So I thought it important that our panellists consider that assumption, and I've asked them to support or to refute that argument with some sort of anecdotal evidence, at least. Secondly, there's the explicit topic. Will emerging markets wish to, and will they be able to afford Asian exchange technology? This, of course, also begs the question, will they wish to, and will they be able to buy European or American technology? I've asked each panellist to talk on the topic for a maximum of 10 minutes, preferably shorter, and that should leave us with 20 minutes to half an hour, hopefully, for question and answer. After all, most of you are from exchanges, and I trust you will have a lot of questions to ask our distinguished panel on this topic. I'd now like to introduce our panel in running order. I'll introduce all five of them, and then we'll get straight on with it, because you want to hear from them and not me. First up will be Mr. Laman Ruttan, who is Joint Managing Director of the Multi-Commodity Exchange of India. This is an exchange with a considerable success story of having achieved very, very significant volumes in a very short space of time. For your information, and Leonella referred to it this morning, prior to joining MCX, Laman spent a considerable time of his career at UNCTAD working in the commodity markets area. Second up will be Richard, to my left, who is Senior Vice President of the Taiwan Futures Exchange. TIFEX is, in a way, an unsung success story of the Asian markets, having a very, very well-traded index options contract, which I think is number six, to my reckoning, in the equity derivatives contracts for futures and options globally. Also, prior to that, just to demonstrate his internationalization, he spent many, many years at the Singapore Exchange, also in business development. At the far end of the table is Kazuaki Takabatake. That's the first time I pronounced his name, because he's all known to us as Kaz, which is much easier to say, of course. Kaz is Regional Director of Asia Pacific for PAT Systems, and Kaz has for several years now been very much the face of PAT Systems in Asia, where, among other things, especially relevant to this conference, he secured deals for PAT Systems with both the Agricultural Futures Exchange of Thailand and the Pakistan Commodity Exchange. Then to my right, we have a late entrant to the panel, Mr. Martin Dempsey, to give him his formal name, otherwise known as Chip. Chip is an independent consultant, formerly head of global strategy for SunGard Futures System for several years, and he's also worked for a large quote vendor and technical analysis vendor, CQG, and after that, he was at the Clearing Corporation in Chicago. And finally, to my far right, we have Jonathan Butler, a project manager of Deutsche Börse Systems, who, among other things, was deeply involved with in cooperation with the EEX, the European Electricity Exchange.
Energy Exchange,
where he worked on the German and French electricity spot market. So without further ado, we'll start with Laman.
Okay. Thank you, David. Okay, MCX, we're India's largest commodity futures market, fully electronic, set up in 2003 by a technology firm called Financial Technologies. It's a company that dominates front ends in India. Software runs on around 100,000 screens. Financial Technologies is still the major shareholder of MCX. The second largest shareholder is State Bank of India, the largest bank in the country. And the technology developed by and maintained by FT is what has really driven MCX. It has driven us to a market value of more than $1 billion in 3 years. We have 400 staff. We have a transaction volume of, on a normal day, $250,000 transactions. We expect to have this year a trading value of more than $500 billion, which sounds better in Spanish when they say $500,000 million. So it's a lot of money. So it's a big success, and success driven by technology. We are a technology firm. Incidentally, the same technology drives the Dubai Gold and Commodities Exchange, in which we have 50% share. Now, let me speak on three topics. First, what makes technology superior? Then, what determines the best choice of technology? The best technology is not necessarily the best choice. And third, how are the prospects of export of Asian technologies to other parts of the emerging world. Okay, to start, what makes technology superior? Well, there are quite a few factors. One is performance in terms of speed, ease of access, and so on. And here we've had the advantage of having already big exchanges in the West. So we could benchmark ourselves, and we were able to develop on the basis of new programming languages, no legacy systems. We knew what the benchmarks were. And not surprisingly, given the strengths of India in the IT industry, it has not been too difficult to meet the benchmarks. So actually, our system does what, in terms of technology, does what CME, CBOT, Western exchanges do. That's what we targeted, that we've been able to perform. The second factor is cost. And here there's a major benefit. Again, there were no legacy systems, so it was possible to use the latest technology. But there are a couple of other factors. One is that we actually run on cheap hardware. We don't need mainframes. The MCX trading system runs on Microsoft platform. Also, because the programming languages are newer, the programmers are younger, and younger programmers are considerably cheaper than older programmers. So maintenance costs are a lot lower. Now, of course, this is something that may disappear if we are careless in the next 10 years or so, but for the time being, we are quite well off in terms of costs. A third factor is robustness. How robust is your trading system? And here, actually, we have an advantage because the Indian environment is very difficult. You need to develop a system that is probably more robust than what you would need in a typical developed economy. And as a result, we have an extremely robust system. We've not had any breakdowns of our trading system. We've had problems in the early beginning with some of the connectivities where we depend on third-party telecommunications firms, but we've had no problems in our own technology, and that's more than many other platforms can say. And the fourth aspect of superiority of technology is in adaptability. How well can you adapt your system to the particular needs and requirements of a particular environment? And there again, the environment in India is difficult. And Financial Technologies had to develop a system that functions in that difficult environment. So as a result, you can now trade on MCX through leased lines, but also through the internet, You can trade through satellites. We have many small satellite terminals. And you can trade even through mobile telephones. Trades directly on our platform, not through a broker, but you trade directly on our platform. We have terminals which are outside of the electricity grid, which run on solar panels, which run on car batteries. Okay, so the system has been made for a pretty tough environment and performs well in that environment. So that's on technological superiority. I'm not saying that our performance standards are higher. In some aspects, we definitely do better. We have faster systems than you see in some of the European and US exchanges. But London Stock Exchange, for example, is a system that is a few milliseconds faster than ours. Okay, so be it. But in other aspects, we are better. Okay, we have higher standards in terms of clearing and so on. So it's technologically is quite superior. So technologically, performance is quite similar. Other aspects are superior in terms of cost, robustness, and adaptability. Now, however, is the best technology always the best choice for developing countries? Here I had to reflect on one of the papers I did at university some 25 years ago on the economic impact of technologies used in the East African shoe industry. There were three levels of technology there. You had Bata, big Western firm, which had Western machinery. You had Indian entrepreneurs who had imported their machinery from India. And you had local indigenous entrepreneurs. Now, the Bata machinery definitely produced the most used fastest. However, the machinery often broke down, and then they had to import spare parts. They couldn't be made locally, and often they had to fly in the engineers to repair the machines. So in the local context, this was the technologically superior solution, but it didn't work well. The local indigenous entrepreneurs didn't have the means to have much technology. And as a result, they did not produce proper quality, and they even had difficulties producing proper at a competitive price. The indigenous entrepreneurs, so the intermediate technology, actually did best. That technology had high-quality shoes, and when there were problems, spare parts could be manufactured locally. There was no need for expatriate engineers, expatriate managers. Now, what this shows is that choice of technology is not a matter of technology alone. It's a matter of the environment in which the technology will function. Now, things have moved on. As I said, our technology now actually is up to Western standards. So from our perspective, the question really is there technology that is inferior to ours, intermediate level technology, that is better than ours as a choice for a developing country? There is definitely cheaper technology out there, which is less performant than ours. Is this perhaps the best choice? Now, here I want to make two points. One point is that in many developing countries, there are major inefficiencies in physical market infrastructure, the existing infrastructure. If you remove one bottleneck, you can only move a little bit before you meet the next bottleneck. So small incremental solutions do not give big gains. And if you can't provide big gains, people will not change their behavior. An exchange that provides partial solutions does not give enough profit opportunities for people to change their behavior. There is a strong argument for a Big Bang effect, for an exchange that is well enough capitalized to make a difference in many fields. We engage in warehousing, we engage in quality controls, we engage in pushing our prices down throughout the country. We have the money to do that. Okay? A Big Bang can be what makes an exchange attractive in an environment which is full of constraints. And you can't cross a canyon in two steps. Okay? You have to make a big jump. Second point, exchange technology is not primarily a way to automate the existing way of doing business. If I know that many people look at it like that. They look, this is what we're doing. We're doing trade. Let's automate it. And perhaps if we automate it, some other people will start using the exchange. That's not really it. An exchange can actually create new markets. And what you used to do will be absorbed into those markets. But at the end of the day, you're creating a whole new big market. With proper technology, you can create a massive new market. You can create completely new markets. And this may not be business as usual. I mean, in the case of Argentina, if you would go for top-notch technology, you would not normally stay concentrated on cereals. The technology is much more performant than that. You can do many more things. Okay? So if you look at technology just as automation, you don't need to go for the best product. But, I mean, that's not how you should look at it. We, on a normal trading day, we have something like 20,000 terminals linked into our system. 20,000 eyeballs, 20,000 pairs of fingers on keyboards. And that is made possible by our technology. You can go to a rural marketplace, completely decrepit condition. Okay, you see heaps of pulses, grains, cotton, spices on the ground. You walk to the back, gloomy place with one light bulb screwed in into the ceiling, but they have a computer linked to our platform, and people are trading on that. Okay, and it's technology that makes it possible, and it's top-notch technology that really makes it possible. Any technology that is not very performant will break down and will be too expensive. Okay, so technology creates markets. Okay, now what are then the prospects of exporting this technology, exporting these products to other developing countries? Can developing countries afford it? Now there, I think the starting point should be what is the potential of these markets. And then, when you know what is the potential, how can you realize the potential, and how much money do you need to realize it? The starting point should not be, we have $1 million, let's see how we can spend it. The moment that you know what is the potential, you can get investors. There are investment sources out there, there are investment funds. We are willing to take equity stakes in all parts of the world. So we are willing to invest, we believe in our product. There is enough money out there to go for the technology that allows you to realize possibilities. You should not be constrained by whatever money you happen to have, whatever money your members are willing to contribute. You should look for the potential. We believe that there is a lot of potential in developing countries. We have grown in 3 years from basically a non-existing company to a $1 billion company. India is, of course, a large country, but there are very, very large opportunities in many other countries. We believe that the money is there. May not be among existing members of an exchange, but you know, you open up. So export possibilities of technology are definitely there. It's a matter of people realizing these possibilities. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you, Lam. We'll move straight on to Richard from Typhex.
Thank you, David. I will take a very short time to just give you a briefing on the Typhex market.
Just get it closer.
First of all, I would like to thank the AFM for giving us the opportunity to be here to meet all of you here. It is really a pleasure to be here and also to be the new member of AFM. We hope that from here on we can work closely and more actively with both AFM as well as the community in the futures community in the world, including Latin America, as well as, those emerging markets in other parts of the world. Typhex is a new exchange. We are just about 10 years old. We started a new company in 1997, and our first contract was listed only in 1998. Currently, the more successful contracts are the options on the index products. Altogether, we have 14 products. The options products represented about 85% of our trading volume, and mainly is the index options. So it's not so much on the commodities as many of us here are today. I will share with you our experience in the market. And in terms of technology, I don't think we have much to boast about other than sharing with you how do we develop, how do we come from, and how we can go forward with you, the audience, as well as the panel speakers here, how we can share our experience. Yeah. In the market, and to start with, Typhex, although it's just 10 years old, but actually we can trace back far longer. We have actually benefited from, in a sense, the development of an unregulated market in Taiwan. Many years ago, the unregulated futures market is very active in Taiwan. then a law was promulgated to address all those issues relating to this unregulated market. As a result, we have actually allowed foreign futures trading first before the domestic markets was formed. So with the foreign futures markets in place, we have all the futures brokers, 20 over of them all together. And this provides a very instant channel of distributions when the exchange was launched. I think this is an experience that many markets probably have not gone through or did not go through. So I think this is an experience, something that I really like to share with you, how our market can have developed and how other expiring exchanges could take a look at us and see how we can our experience can be of use to you. Today, we actually have trading about 114 million contracts a year, which is roughly about 500,000 contracts a day, which is a reasonably active market. Very much is a domestic market. 90% of the trades come from domestic investors, both retail and institutions. Of course, for a start, our market is mostly of retail base, more than 90%, in fact, for a start, retail investors. And today, something like about 40% of the trades come from retail investors, meaning that about almost 60% come from institutional investors. And these institutional investors are mostly those market makers as well as proprietary trading houses, and most of them are also members of the exchange. In system-wise, we use our own proprietary system. When we started, we worked together with the Taiwan Stock Exchange based on the Taiwan Stock Exchange trading system and develop our own futures trading system. That was the futures market. Of course, when we launched the options contract, which is more successful today, we also use our own internal developed system. We are not using the other external system. Of course, in terms of technology-wise, we are not the most advanced system, but it's adequate to meet our needs. It's stable, able to expand, and also able to meet the needs of today's market. And in the coming years, we should be able to expect our system to meet our needs. In fact, just recently, we have managed to expand the capacity and also speed up the system by a factor of 3. I think that has actually provided a more user-friendly system. Of course, going forward, we are going to expand the system further to align with those of the international markets. Things that we are going to do include, for example, some of those spread trading, spend margin system. We are going to adopt all this system to make our markets more in line with those of the international markets. In terms of also market development, an area I think also quite unique to Taiwan will be the pre-margin system. Pre-margin to many of the users, pre-margin is basically we require all traders to post margins with the brokers and with the exchange before the trades can be consummated, before they can start trading. This is something that not very commonly practiced in other parts of the world, but it serves our purpose very well. It's number one, it provides protections to both the brokers and the exchange. In other words, when we started the market, we do not need a very huge capital. And yet, we can provide very adequate investor protections in terms of credit risk. I think we have done very well so far. Until now, we have not met with any of these incidents of, giving us any problem with our investor protection. In terms of, the margining, in terms of, clearing system, we do not develop ourselves, but we make use of the system developed by the Taiwan's Central Depository Clearing System. So, meaning actually we work together with other Taiwan organizations to meet the respective needs of the market. So together with our trading system, with our clearing system, we are so far able to meet all the needs. For a start, our market started mostly on the retail market and also the domestic market. We are actually in the process of liberalizing our market, attracting more foreign participations. But at the same time, also sharing with the audience here, we have actually concern about the ability of the retail investor in the trading, in the technologies, in the risk management, even in the funding. So we actually, while we want to open the market, we also want to protect the investor and also give them adequate protections, also the skills and technology. So our focus for the coming 1 or 2 years will very much be on investor educations to make sure that these people are able to equip themselves and to meet the market. So far on the sharing of experience in terms of technology-wise, we'd be happy to share with any expiring exchanges how we have done, what we have done, or what are the issues that we have met. We also be working with other exchanges in Asia regions, including Thailand's exchange, to provide also our assistance, our technologies, you know, our experience in managing the market, in building the market, in developing the market. In particular, for example, in the options market, I think we have one of the few exchanges in Asia where we have relatively adequate experience. And I mentioned about the Thailand Future Exchange because they are also in the process of listing their options contract. So that is an area we can provide assistance, not just to Thailand, but also to provide experience and also sharing of our resources with expiring exchanges in Asia as well as outside of Asia. I think that much I just want to share with you. Let's say in terms of other area, of course, let's say in terms of risk management, market surveillance, data dissemination, all these things, I think let's say if we need to talk more about that, I'd be very happy to share with you at the end of this conference or in these sessions, or even let's say later you could let's say you can raise some questions on that. And I pass the floor back to David. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard, and we'll pass straight on to Kaz.
Good afternoon. I've already measured my speech, and it's no longer than 7 minutes, so it's not a lot to go through. Just very quickly, PAT Systems, some of you know us, some of you don't. We were founded in 1994 and listed on the London Stock Exchange in year 2000. We're currently listed on the London Stock Exchange Alternative Investment Market. And if you just pull up our charts over the last 3-4 weeks, we're one of the best performing stocks on the market itself. Our shares have gone up by at least double, so worth keeping an eye on. What do? We have a twin-pillared business of providing technologies to both members and exchanges. In terms of our member business, we provide the likes of people like Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, Lehman Brothers, our recent signing, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this, Pat, but I'm going to say it, Citibank, and through to people like FEMAT and Callion. Through those exchange members, we executed around 300 million contracts last year. That would have put us in the top 10 in terms of exchange volumes, so we do contribute a lot towards exchange to all the exchanges globally. In terms of our exchange business, our focus up until about 3 years ago has been mainly into the Japanese markets, which is the Tokyo Grain Exchange, Central Commodity Exchange, the Kansai Exchange, and the Fukuoka Exchange. There's been a lot of mergers between all the exchanges, and our business, or our, I guess, the arena is getting smaller, but there's a lot of consolidation in the markets. We executed around 40 million contracts through our system last year in 2006. Anyway, just to get back to the topic, can the technological leadership of Asian exchanges be exported to emerging markets? I don't know if we fit in as the Asian exchange business because our headquarters are based in London, but I'm going to give you a very quick view of where we think we are. First point I'd like to point out is that Asia is a very, very large continent. It spans all the way from India, Pakistan out in the west, all the way through Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Korea, Hong Kong, and Japan. Okay, I'm sure I've left a lot out as well. But it's a very, very big area, and it's difficult to generalize what I'm going to tell you based on Asia. So I'm going to talk about what I know best, which is in the Japanese markets. Okay, I think we've already heard from Lamont and Richard on how they see the technology in their areas is progressing and how they feel it could be exported to emerging markets. I think Lamont highlighted the fact that the advantages that they had, or the MCX had, was that they were a new exchange with new technology and that they had no legacy systems. Okay, I come from the other side. Just to give you an idea how old we are in Japan, if you look through the CME website, there is a little line that says CME Globex, launched in 1992 as the world's first global electronic trading platform. Was it really the first? We're also familiar with the success of the bigger European and US exchanges, so much so that we tend to forget where all of this really originated from. Just to go back, Tokyo Stock Exchange, going through their website, implemented a computer-assisted order routing and execution system in 1982. And the JGB future, which was their first future contract, went live on that system in 1985. That's 7 years before CME ever did. The point then to note from that is that they've recently announced that they're going to be updating their system by the end of Q3 2007. It is with the same vendor that provided the system to them back in 1985. So there's a bit of continuity. The Osaka Stock Exchange, they implemented a computer trading system in 1988 with full computerization of their exchange in 1999. They recently implemented a new system in the end of 2006, which has been a very, very big upgrade, and it's been going very, very well, and their volumes, if you look on their website, have been going up significantly. Tokyo Grain Exchange, they converted from floor trading to computerized trading in 1988 as well. They then changed their vendor to PAT Systems in 1996, and they recently also installed a new continuous market system in 2006 through PAT Systems. And just one final one, Tokyo Financial Exchange, they introduced a fully automated system in 1991 with an upgrade to a system in 2003 supplied by OM Technologies, with Euronext Life Connect. And an upgrade of this system is up and coming. I think what the point I'm trying to make here is that, first of all, electronic trading at exchanges has been around a hell of a lot longer than the CME think, and it's been around a long time in Japan. In Japan, we're already in the third cycle of the evolution of development, the first one being in the late 80s where the initial systems were installed. We went through the next one just before the millennium, and we're now going through the third stages of evolution. The Japanese exchanges have been upgrading their system in the past 2 years to keep up with the, you know, what we think is the global standard, which is what we're seeing in Europe, US, and also in India as well. We fully acknowledge that. Another point to note here is the reliance of the Japanese exchanges on outside vendors to provide their technology. During lunch, this came up as well, actually. European and US exchanges tend to do their development in-house, a lot of them. And correct me if I'm wrong on that, Jonathan, but you see CME with their Globex platform predominantly down in-house, Life Connect, same with Eurex. Japanese exchanges tend to outsource this business out. This has also meant that it's been very slow in making decisions on upgrades and updates as opposed to European and US exchange counterparts. And they've been much quicker to respond and accommodate. Although we were one of the first to go electronic and therefore be, I guess, the leaders at one point in this evolution of exchange systems, we're now very, very far behind due to long and laborious selection processes that were predominant in Japan. Also, with the bursting of the bubble in the late 90s, people were reluctant to make further investment. The one thing I'd like to point here is that we have made the next step up during the last 2 years in Japan, and I do believe that most of the technology that is available with Japanese exchanges by the end of this year will be concurrent and will be with the latest technology available in the markets. I mean, technology, whether you're in an exchange, a member, or a vendor like us, is always a case of gauging where you are in the development cycle. You're always playing catch-up, or you're always leading, or you're always catching up. It changes. You're one day leader. Next day, someone else is going to come in. We have this problem as an ISV. We have this problem as an exchange system provider. One day, we're leading. Someone else takes over. So I guess it depends what your set of requirements as an exchange is. And this is something that, you know, I don't think is a technology issue. It's more what your vendor can provide you with. Where should we go next? Okay, I mean, I think the one other thing that we can actually pick up from the Japanese story, and that can be exported to the emerging markets, and this is for free, is the history and the experience gained in Japan and the mistakes we've made in Japan from being one of the first to provide electronic exchanges. And, you know, my advice would be, if you already have a system, to try and maintain continuity with the same vendor, because you're going to maintain the same platform. It's going to be a much easier transition for your members. And also, one thing that the Japanese markets never did was to maintain constant upgrades, constant updates of the system. In summary, I think all the technology, it doesn't matter whether you're in the US or Europe or Asia, it can be exported from one country to another. It is a requirement that the exchanges, and this is from a financial point of view, there's no point wanting an X system if it's too much, it's too expensive. From a functional point of view, there are requirements that certain countries in Asia require that a European vendor can't provide, and vice versa. Culturally, this is a very, very important thing. If your culture does not mix well with the vendor, then you have a problem. And those are the items that will determine your selection. We're a living proof of this. PAT Systems currently exports our technology to the emerging markets, including Thailand through the Agricultural Futures Exchange of Thailand, Pakistan through National Commodity Exchange Limited, and China. I can't go too much into that one. So those are in addition to three domestic exchanges we provide. So we are currently already exporting our technology to emerging markets. Just to sort of finally summarize, there's a lot of high-quality technology being used by Asian exchanges, some specific to Asian requirements, but it's my belief that the technology available in Asia can, without doubt, be utilized by the emerging markets. Lastly, going back to David's original question, is it leading technology or is Asia leading technology? My point, it doesn't matter. It shouldn't things like track record, experience, and also the exchanges requirement be much, much more important factor than just technology-wise? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kaz. And with two speakers to go, I want you to start getting your questions ready. We're going to move on, but get your questions ready, please. We'll move on to Chip.
Thank you. Thank you very much for including me in the panel. And in the spirit of last night's toasts, I hope that among friends I can make some helpful comments and leave us time to discuss. I want to disclaim any sort of technological expertise immediately. And I also want to congratulate my fellow panelists on the success of their organizations, which I think is tremendous. So I'll share with you some experience that I've had in working with a client of mine, which is called Communicating Limited. They're based in London, so they fail on the Asian export opportunity. But I'll talk briefly about sort of the promise of electronic trading and where I think that it's fallen short based on this experience. So the promise was always that electronic trading would be better, faster, cheaper. And so far, I think that that's kind of unfulfilled. It's counterintuitive given the volume that you've seen and the growth with the electronic exchanges. But there's sort of two questions that I'll use to illustrate my point. One is, if the futures pits are replicated, isn't that good enough? And the second question is, if I'm an emerging market with low volumes, aren't super high volume matching engines overkill? And so I'll address those two things. In terms of isn't replicating the futures pit good enough, that's kind of like saying if a car can go as fast as a horse, is it good enough? The point is that there's a tremendous amount of unrealized potential, and I'm going to address that mostly in the second point. But one card that's not as fast as the horse is options trading. And I'm going to disclaim any knowledge about how TIFEX's options market work, because I honestly don't know. But where in the West or in the more developed markets you've seen side-by-side trading electronic and the pit, Electronic trading tends to draw about 15% of the volume, and 85% is still done in the pit. Where there's been sort of a cold turkey approach to electronic markets, when Life went electronic, you've seen a lot of the options market actually migrate to the OTC market and not replicate at all electronically what had been there with market makers. The market makers are kind of the cornerstone of options markets, and so when it moves OTC, you lose transparency and you also lose liquidity for a lot of market participants. So the two reasons that I would maintain that options markets haven't been replicated electronically the way they were in the pit is message traffic and aggregate risk. Message traffic is pretty much a numbers game. Every time the underlying moves up or down a tick, there's 20 actively traded strikes. There's a put and a call each. There's a bid and an offer for each. So to send a message to pull your bid and resubmit a new bid, pull your offer, resubmit a new offer, you're talking about 160 messages to one. The exchanges, the Western exchanges, largely can't handle that amount of message traffic. The bandwidth is not practicable. So what they do is they tend to negotiate sort of a ratio. For every fill, send 10 messages, but keep it manageable. And the way that market makers are really able to accommodate that is by widening their spreads. You don't have to change it that often when your spreads are wider. That's the message traffic problem. The aggregate risk problem, I used to be an options local, a market maker. And when the broker would come into the pit and say, what's there in the DEES 210 corn calls, I know that if my aggregate risk is 50 vega, it's 100 contracts, and I'd say, three and three quarters bid at 400 up. Well, if electronically I'm quoting 20 strikes, I can't be 100 up in each of them. I could get picked off across the whole skew, and my aggregate risk parameter has been shattered. I had enough trouble with that in the pit. So what firms do to compensate for that is they show smaller sizes. So you've got wider bid-ask spreads, and you've got smaller amounts. So effectively, the liquidity dissipates or disappears or migrates to OTC, but there haven't been a lot of successful migrations of options markets from the pit to electronic trading. Now, growing it organically from electronic, I don't know how to really compare that. But so the communicating guys are an interesting bunch. There's one of them is originally an options market maker, another is a anabolistic engineer, and they came up with the idea that really the market maker, he trades off of his sheets, and the sheets are generated by his theoretical option value calculator. Maybe it's Black-Scholes or Cox-Ross-Rubenstein or something that he develops himself. They said, couldn't you just take the sheets and embed them inside the matching platform? So they took the ability, sort of the calculator, and they put an encryption technology on it. And then they said, okay, now you put that within the memory of the matching platform. So the matching platform feeds it the underlying price, and it generates the bid and offer, however wide the market maker wants his bid-ask spread to be. And every iteration of the matching platform, you've got fresh prices, and it's not using any bandwidth at all. So I think that's a fairly novel and clever approach, and that's one of the things about communicating limited that I find sort of compelling. The other thing that I'll talk about is the overkill, the overkill idea. So if the mature or Western exchanges are matching 5,000 matches per second, does an emerging market or a market that has relatively low volume really need to match 5,000 matches per second? Or do they need, 100,000? Isn't that massive overkill? I think that the question is answered if you figure out what the goal is. Is the goal volume or is the goal liquidity? Because if the goal is getting your customers' orders filled, then it's about liquidity. And this is where the unrealized potential of electronic markets lies, I think, is in implied spreads. Now, an implied spread, I'll do a quick illustration. I'll use corn again. Say there's a guy bidding in the December contract and a guy offering in the March contract, and neither of them are getting their orders filled. There's another guy who's offering the December-March spread, and he's not getting his order filled. If the matching technology can take the outright bid in December, the outright offer in March, and create an implied spread out of it that matches with the outright spread offer, then actually all three get done. The existing technologies almost all support implied spreading, and that's great. Where there's limitations is that there's a limited number of strategies that are supported, and they tend only to support two-legged spreads. Now, the ability of implied spreads to sort of increase liquidity is something that only increases as you add the number of strategies and as you add the number of legs. So there's actually a farther step that you can take it, which is to create implied spreads on implied spreads. The communicating technology, it's pretty darn fast. They were certified. They sort of had a study done by, I want to say it's Accenture, IBM, and Cisco, and this is several years ago, but they certified them on I think 54,000 transactions a second, and that was actually running on a 486. So if you want to talk about commoditized hardware, I think that was an interesting illustration point. They can do now many multiples of 54,000 transactions or matches a second, and this might be seen as a massive overkill, but what they've actually done with that capacity is they've increased the number of strategies and implied spreads. So they're doing legs that have maybe 40 legs. Now, if you only have four maturities, this is of limited value. There's only so many permutations you can do. But if you've got like the Eurodollar contract, which goes out 10 or 12 years, I'm not sure, and four maturities each, there's all kinds of combinations that you can create sort of better liquidity by creating more and more of these implied spreads. So I'll give you, if I were somebody in the audience, I'm thinking I would wonder, well, how much liquidity does that actually add to the market, these implied spreads? How much does that actually help? The communicating technology has been used in a trading application where they basically take existing exchanges, order books, they download it to their platform, and then they recompile it using all these implied spreads. So they can kind of see implied spreads that other participants, unless they're doing the same math, don't really see. And the markets that they're trading are ICE and the Board of Trade and the Merck and Eurex and Euronext Life. And their volume on a daily basis is going to be anywhere from like 2 to 7% of those exchanges. And they only trade arbitrage. So that means the bid and the offer have backwardated. So the bid is above the offer. So that when they trade it, it's a straight arbitrage. They're just taking money out of it. So there's minimally 2 to 7% of liquidity that could be added with the implied on implied. And I'll give you another illustration, then I'll finish. The illustration is, in January, the Chicago Board of Trade, for a period of a couple weeks, disabled implied spreading on their electronic platform. And for that period, or for actually the month of January, the guys using this platform accounted for 30% of the volume in agricultural products at the Chicago Board of Trade. Now, that'll give you an idea, I think, an accurate idea of the value of implied spreading. So having the additional capacity, even for a low-volume exchange, if you can use it to create more and more of these implied spreads, I think you can create more liquidity. Sort of in conclusion, technology's really come a long way, but not far enough. In options, I'd argue that it's not good enough. In implieds, that's sort of where the unfulfilled promise is. And I've got an FOW article if anybody is interested. And otherwise, anyone who wishes to contact me, I guarantee I'll be around. And thank you again for having me.
Thank you very much, Chip. And last but by no means least, as they say, Jonathan Butler.
So thank you very much, David. First of all, I mean, it's a great pleasure to be here, to be invited by the AFM to speak on this panel, and to be here in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, for the first time in my life. It's a fantastic experience, so it's great to be here. Where to start? So many interesting points. I have the advantage of, maybe it's an advantage of being last, I enjoy to try to tie in the points from my fellow panel members. Maybe, however, to begin with, just a short background about Deutsche Börse Systems, the company that I work for. We're providing the technology for the systems of the Deutsche Börse Group. So our two main trading platforms, which are Eurex for the derivatives market, etc. for the German cash market. We're providing for the whole chain, so that includes right through trading front office, front ends for the members, through to risk management systems, middle office, back office, clearing settlement, on the way down there, risk management, also systems for market data and analytics. It's a very big operation. The markets, the business has grown at a tremendous pace in the last years, and it's presently also growing very fast. So that obviously puts great demands upon us, our organization providing the technology. We have to also move fast. Recurring theme. I mean, we've heard about it in our panel. Obviously, it's a technology panel, but obviously, also in the panel previous to this one, I think all the members of the panel touched upon the importance of technology for their business, the role that technology is taking, and it's something which I find very fascinating as a professional working in technology sector for market application. Is the interplay basically between the business and technology. You have to have business requirements. I mean, you can't just, anyone can establish an electronic trading system and install it and put it there, but I mean, if you don't have underlying business that's going to come to trade on that platform, well, then it's not going to be good for anyone. And sort of vice versa, at the other end of the spectrum, well, you know, if you have big business requirements and demands, as we have, for example, at Eurex, well, then as a technology provider, you're also not going to be doing your job if you can't keep up with those requirements. So it's something I, as a professional in the technology sector, find fascinating, I must say, is, well, the interplay between technology on one side and the business of markets on the other side. The title of the panel is asking about, well, you know, do the Asian technology providers, Asian markets have better technology than European or US, or vice versa? Will you know, Asian or emerging markets want to or be able to afford to buy, for example, technology solutions from Europe or the US? I think, again, in my opinion, you know, it's really the point is that you have to have the technology to do the job. I mean, as I mentioned before, it's a very close, very sort of intricate interplay, coexistence between technology, the application of technology, and the business. So, I mean, it's really, as I said before, basically repeating myself, I mean, you have to have the technology to fit the business. So, again, I mean, it's there's no point buying wonderful, I'm not sure, European technology from Eurex or also excellent technology from Le Monde's parent organization or from CAS. At PAT Systems, there's no good buying technology for technology's sake. You've got to have the technology to do the job. Interesting that sort of tying in with some points from fellow panel members, interesting that meet on similar key points to Lamont, not actually having discussed things in advance. I think that's happened before, actually. Sort of key aspects to success of technology systems for business, I would definitely say are scalability. So, I mean, you have to have a platform, you have to have technology, software, hardware, communications, whatever that is, let's just call it technology, has to be scalable. Who knows when, well, as we on our systems in Germany had a week before last, a couple of weeks ago, with the correction in the equity market, for example, suddenly, completely out of the blue, from one day to the next, we had sort of 2.5 to 3 times average volume in one day. So that was completely unforeseen to us. The systems were very resilient and stood up to that. It was no problem. That's sort of illustration of one aspect which I think is key, which is scalability of your systems. You have to have systems which can, again, it's the key point, you have to have systems which can scale and handle, cope with the business which is required to do so. Also flexibility is a key. Nobody can predict the future. We're professionals working in futures markets, options market. Nobody can predict the future when my colleagues, the forefathers at Sofex and DTB, designed the original parts of the what makes up today's Eurex system. I mean, when they started back in 1985, which is flexible, which will allow you to accommodate new requirements from business, which will also allow you to try new initiatives from a technology side. Again, it's an interplay between business and technology, new requirements coming from the business side, but also new technologies coming in. I think, as Lamont said, you have to invest in your business and sort of have faith in the products and the business that you're doing. I think in the last panel we also discussed, somebody mentioned innovation. And I see that really as a very important key thing in the industry, is being innovative. Okay, so I mean, you need then, from a technology perspective, it's a technology panel. You have to be able to be flexible to try new things out, see if it works. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it does work. Maybe as we've had experience with the Eurex system, for example, okay, we implement something new and, well, nobody really thinks it's going to be a success. And then suddenly 6 months later, or maybe later than that, 1-2 years down the line, whatever we've built into the system is a huge success and it's tremendously used, a fantastic thing for the business, and we're generating great revenues with that. So flexibility, innovation, sort of flexibility allowing you to be innovative is something which is also key. And also, as Lamont said, stability and reliability. Okay, you have to have a system which is resilient. And that, again, depends on the business, depends on the markets which you're serving. Resilience, well, for MCX in India, with systems which are running off car batteries, for example, that's obviously different requirements to what we have with Eurex. I'm not sure there are any Eurex members who are running their installations off car batteries, but, well, I may be wrong. You have to have stability and reliability and resilience of these systems. They have to be tough to be able to handle what's coming your way. Who knows? As I said a couple of weeks ago, suddenly your volumes triple. You have to have resilient systems. Yeah, so those are sort of key points from key aspects of having successful technology from my side. What are we doing at the moment with Eurex and etc. system? We have, I enjoyed very much Patrick Young's stewardship of the dinner last night, and he expressed his passion for speed in motor car racing. We've also acquired quite some passion for speed at with Eurex and etc. We've been investing quite heavily in the last year, last months, on speeding up our systems, increasing transaction round trips, network communication bandwidth. We've got a lot of new concepts that's also going further. Again, that's another example of the interesting aspect between this interplay between business and technology. I mean, obviously, there has to be a business requirement to bring the turnover onto your system. But then, as we've observed with Eurex, also with etc., as we speed up the technology, as we improve the technology, that seems to generate even more business. So it's really a sort of two-way thing between the business and technology. That's really basically rounds it up for me, I think, David, yeah.
Thank you, Jonathan. Now the people that can really answer the question, the original question is set, are in the audience. So I do hope you're going to ask that help give us an answer to the question. Are there any questions from the audience, either directly to the question or statements from our emerging exchange people in particular in the audience, or anybody else, system suppliers? The gentleman there.
I would like somebody from the panel to comment last February's down move where the NICE calculator failed, resulting in a 5-minute, 5% nearly crash, right? So I would like to see if somebody has some comment on that, because there definitely the system didn't work. No? So
I think possibly Jonathan's best position to comment on that.
Yeah.
It's not his system, by the way.
Sure. It's not my system.
He's the most technology.
In a great position, yeah. I mean, of course, like in any industry, in any business, there's great rivalry between the different organizations. And, you know, when let's say when other competing organizations have difficulties, some of my colleagues may derive some pleasure from that. I'm not one of them. Each and every one of us working in the technology field for exchanges, we all have our hard times now and again. I think it's just a very difficult thing to predict. I mean, as I explained, we had the volumes on our systems as well, etc., in Eurex 2 weeks ago. We were up three times average volume in one day. We were lucky our technology was scalable. We could handle those things. But, I mean, it's very difficult to know when the next such event, let's say, is going to happen. Is one sort of unknown, which you have to work with. Second sort of unknown is, well, I mean, I take our sort of system landscape, for example, and, I mean, we have systems, Murex and et cetera, the downstream systems, the clearing settlement systems. The second unknown is sort of, well, within your company or within your market's system landscape, the second unknown is trying to determine, okay, when the next such event comes, where are the hotspots going to be? Where's there going to be a hole in the dike, which I have to put my finger in? Where's the next hole in the dike? I can see Alan laughing. So really, you know, it's basically, in that sense, as a technology provider, you're trying to manage somehow the risk. Okay, you don't know when the next such event is going to come, and when the next event does come, it will come. You can't be sure how and in what way it's going to affect your systems. And I mean, basically, at the Deutsche Börse Group, we try to accommodate for that. We have a rolling program of investment in our technology. We're reviewing our technology, the operation of our systems on a constant basis. We're always trying to improve from the event to 2.5 weeks ago, we, of course, learned a lot of interesting things. We didn't have any problems with the system, but how should I say, the systems were in some aspects quite heavily loaded. So it's basically a process of learning from experiences like that, trying to predict the future events, trying to predict how things are going to develop, and really investing in the technology and having a constant program of review and improvement is our approach to that.
Kaz? Just to highlight on that, I mean, believe me, it's not intentional. And from a software company's point of view, it's the last thing you want to see another exchange go through that problem, because, you know, us being providers as well, it's what you have nightmares about, to be honest with you. And we do go through every single procedure that, you know, you can inform an exchange, you know, you should try this, you should try that, different testing. And we do a lot of, you know, stress testing. But unfortunately, there is not, there it's very difficult to cover every single aspect of it. But as Jonathan rightly said, you know, we try and assist, well, from a technology provider's point of view, we try and assist exchange by looking at operational aspects of it, trying to improve it from that aspect. But unfortunately, it's one of those things that happen. And as long as no one is disadvantaged and it's across the board, so if one member is trading but the others can't trade, yes, that you have a problem. But if the procedures are correct and the exchange needs to be terminated, you know, it needs to be across the board. So it is something that we try and avoid, but what can I say on that one? Right. I mean, you find me a system that never goes down, I'll buy it.
Maybe I can give one example of the... I mean, okay, system can crash because it is obsolete, can't deal with the volumes. I mean, that's one thing. But you can have a perfectly good system where there's one little aspect that has been overlooked. One case that I know of, not us, is an exchange that electronic trading allocated trading terminals to members. Each member was allowed to link 6 computers to that trading terminal. And each terminal that was linked got a number. So the client had a code, a series of numbers, and then the last number gave the number of the specific computer. Now, one day, one of the brokers connected an 11 computer. There was only space for 10 numbers. That made the system crash. And I think it was down for more than an hour before they found out what had really happened. Now, tiny little things that I mean, you have rules in place. People will break the rules. Is your system then able to deal with that? So you always need to have procedures in place. What would you actually do if something like that happens?
And am I right? It wasn't actually the supplier of the service. It was the Dow Jones people, wasn't it? The index computation that blew it. Yeah.
As far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Any other question? We're just a couple of minutes over, but I think there's time for one more. Alan at the back, and we'll have one more from Mr. Sidoma after that. Yeah.
Yes, I would like to just react very shortly on the remark of Chip concerning options and electronic trading. As he said that he has the feeling that if you have options on an environment that doesn't work that well and they tend to go OTC. I'm from Euronext Live. I've been responsible for migrating the Amsterdam options market into a electronic environment, and we have developed a model in Amsterdam in which I think it improved the trading of equity options, index options, and all of our other products which we now trade through this model. What I saw is when we left the trading floor in Amsterdam, we had a daily volume of around 220,000 contracts a day. And if you look at it right now, we trade around 600,000 contracts a day. Some days, lately, the last few weeks, we did more than 1 million. And Amsterdam is, well, more or less a more option market than a futures market. We only have one future or an important future on the index. But so I do not agree with you that there are not good models on the electronic environment to trade options. It's done in Amsterdam. We have migrated the model to Brussels, which have improved the quality of the market there substantially. The same we are doing now in Paris.
with the top 20 CAC 40 classes, and we will also add the CAC 40 in the same model, in which you will really see that you improve the quality, the shopping window of the exchange with tight prices, bigger volumes. Because what you have in a floor environment is you've got the traders on the floor, you've got bids and offers, but the auction is done on the floor. So you do not see the best prices which are distributed by those exchanges. If you're in an electronic environment, the trader has to put his best bid or his best offer on the screen, otherwise he is not in the market at all. And, well, that's my reaction, that equity options do very well on the screen environment. And to Cass, just for your knowledge, Euronext outsourced all the IT, so that's it.
Thank you, Alan. I think Alan and Chip can have a chat about that afterwards, and anybody that wants to join in, they're invited. But we'll just have one more question for Mr. Sodomo, and then we'll break for coffee.
I have a question for Lamont. Because of his internet trading and the Microsoft portion, they are well-known weak spot for viruses. How do you protect against that?
Thank you. Well, nowadays, actually, the weak spot of internet trading is that it's a bit slower than trading through a lease line. So we've had the majority of our brokers, even relatively small ones, migrating from the internet to lease lines. Viruses, no, it's not that difficult. We have many, many virus attacks. Our firewalls, in a briefing that I got from our people dealing with that, they told me that we get an average of something like 200,000 attacks a day. But the firewalls are now good enough. We managed to cope with it. Each trading terminal, including internet terminals, is identified. You cannot have some computer in Russia which suddenly starts trading on our platform. I mean, our technology doesn't make that possible. Hari, I mean, can you add something on the way that we keep internet safe against the viruses? Okay. So he will discuss it with you.
Okay, thank you. We are just running over a little, so we will now go to coffee. I'd like to conclude by thanking all our panelists and invite you back to the last session of the day in about half an hour, or 20 minutes now, is it? Thank you.